So this is our 100th episode. And over the course of the last 100 episodes, we have identified a lot of things. I don't really know what else to call them. Little patterns of behavior, weird phenomena of the mind. I don't know. Things. And we've started making a list of all of these things. And we figured it would be a good idea to kind of read through the list very quickly and try to describe them. So we have this master list that's now on our website, and we are going to go through 50 of these. That's as much as we have. It'd be very satisfying if we had 100, but we could only come up with 50, so that's what we're going to do. And so very quickly, one by one, I guess we'll get started. Number one, the guilt snowball.
Okay, so now begins our speed run of 50 things. So the guilt snowball is one of the first things we talked about. This is when you have something that you need to do and it's important in some way and you don't do it, you procrastinate on it somehow. And then because you've procrastinated on it, you feel more guilty about it, and it starts to build this momentum where you continue to procrastinate, and it continues to become this emotional burden that gets bigger and bigger, and eventually it's this insurmountable thing that you just can't do for no reason. It just went on for so long that it's spiraled into this giant thing.
Great explanation. Number two, the Batman effect.
Yeah, these are clearly not in any particular order because we talked about the Batman effect pretty recently.
Yeah, these are not in chronological order or even alphabetical order. They're just completely random.
Yeah. But okay, the Batman effect, one of my favorites. This was something that was observed in children, where investigators had the children act as themselves, just that they gave them little tests and whatnot, and then they had them pretend to be Batman and do the same types of tests. And across the board, with the one exception of very, very young kids who probably didn't even know what was happening, all the kids performed dramatically better when they were in their Batman persona. They performed an entire grade level higher. So consider like fourth grade to fifth grade, massive gap there. And it was believed that it had to do with what they called the distancing effect, where the more in your head you are, the more self-aware and focused on this is me in a tense situation taking a test. The farther away from that you are, the more performance, the better you are at whatever it is you're doing. So pretending to be Batman takes you to the far end of the spectrum where you're not even you anymore. You're just Batman.
Okay. We're doing great on time, so this is a pretty good pace.
All right. Great.
Number three, the novelty effect.
This one's pretty simple. When you discover something new or you get excited about an idea, you start a new exercise program, it feels very exciting. It tends to occupy your mind quite a lot. It's just this thing that you think about all the time. You have a lot of energy. You have a lot of motivation. And after about 2 weeks-ish, plus or minus however long, that's all kind of gone. And you just don't really feel that same sense of motivation. And part of the, not antidote, but a good way to approach this or to think about it is to lean into the novelty effect when you're really excited, do all that, but think about what it's going to take to make that thing a long-standing habit. Like, where is it actually going to go inside your schedule? What is going to prompt you to do it in the future when it isn't on your mind all the time?
And also not to beat yourself up about the excitement going away.
That's the natural cycle of things. That's the novelty effect.
Number four, future you.
This is you from the future, which tends to be a fantasy superhuman version of you. You think of somehow doesn't suffer from the same flaws and struggles and whatnot. And often you will think something like, I'm not going to do my taxes today because I feel like crap. I will do them next week when I'm going to feel amazing. And it won't be hard at all. That's future you.
The focus train. This one, I can take this one.
Yeah, you take this one. You made this up.
Okay. So this was one of my first metaphors forever ago. But the focus train. I was thinking about focus as sort of this giant, super heavy train that's at a total dead stop on the tracks. And you start to push it, and it just barely starts to move. And it's just barely moving. And then you check your phone, and then the train stops. And then you got to start over again. And then you got to start pushing it, and it just slowly starts to move, and it's really hard. And then someone walks in the room, you lose your focus, and the train stops again. What you want is, at the very beginning of trying to focus on something, you need to get past the slow, drudging push of that train. If you are able to kind of carry it through, or you're pushing or pushing, and it starts to get a little easier, and then it starts to go faster, and it starts to pick up speed, then you can jump on the focus train, and it will carry you.
When you said this originally, I thought this was the dumbest metaphor. Like, you don't push a train. That's not how they work.
Yeah, no, I don't. Yeah.
But every morning when I start working on stuff, I always, without exception, think about the focus train and how I have to push it for a while and don't stop, because that's how focus works. And once it gets going, then I can just ride along and it's fine. So I hate it.
Okay, number
stuck.
Well, I think those are the best ones. Number six, anything you do is the wrong thing.
This is a mental state you can get into. I think it corresponds a lot with when you're feeling stressed, or it's part of what is making you stressed, where you have a hard time doing really anything. Because I remember this happened to me in school. I would sit down to practice guitar. I was a music major, so this made sense. And I'm just filled with guilt of, oh, I need to be studying for my theory test, or, oh, I need to be doing this other thing. It just, you're like torn in all these different directions. A good antidote to this, or at least a tool to help, is the Pomodoro technique, which we'll talk about. But sort of kind of time boxing, you know, making the conscious choice of, I am going to spend my time on this thing. I have decided it's important. And then locking yourself into just focusing on that thing and knowing that there is an endpoint, and you don't need to be making that decision constantly of, okay, should I stop? Should I do this sort of thing? Just figure it out. Put in the effort and then switch to the other thing. And that can help a lot with this. Also, you're probably just stressed out and need to chill a little bit.
Number seven, the dark playground.
We did not make this up. This was Tim Urban from Wait But Why, but it's great. This is a state you can get into, especially as a procrastinator or just somebody who struggles with life like us, where you're supposed to be working. And so you kind of work, but then you kind of goof around and waste time and watch YouTube videos and scroll around on Instagram. And then you kind of go back to work and you kind of go back to goofing off. And then 5 o'clock comes and you're like, well, I'm not really done with work, so I can't really just go relax and do whatever. I kind of still have to work. So you kind of just keep working and you kind of keep goofing off. And your whole life just becomes this blurry, disgusting mess where you're never really doing anything. You're just sort of drifting between wasting time and sort of working, and it's just the worst thing. That's the dark playground.
Winner's tilt.
When you win a lot, somewhat counterintuitively, you often want to stop the thing that you're doing. And conversely, when you lose a lot, you can run into the opposite effect where you just keep going. Sort of like the sunk cost fallacy, where, you know, you're gambling and you got to get it back and you got to get it back. Winner's tilt, it's probably something that you're trying to protect your ego somehow. For me, if I'm playing a competitive game and I go on this big win streak, I'm like, cool, I'm done. I'm out of here. I'm going to go just do something else and not even think about it. I don't want to play anymore. It's scary. I feel like I've climbed up on this high tower and I'm getting higher and higher. And I don't want to fall off. That's winner's tilt.
Number nine, spaghetti flinging.
I don't remember ever saying that.
Well, I think you put this on the list.
Yeah, so. I think it was a concept that just needed a name, so we gave it a stupid name. This is when you just sort of do stuff without really being thoughtful or focused, or you're just kind of trying things and hoping that they work. It represents a very bad state of mind. I'm trying to think of a good example and nothing's really coming to mind, but
for me recently, it's been, I'll work in my sketchbook. No, I'll start working on a bigger canvas or whatever. No, I'll work on this sketchbook. No, I'll update website. I'll go work on social media. And it's just, I just kind of try all these things at once and never actually do any of them.
One comparison that comes up is, you remember playing Melee, like Super Smash?
Yes.
And if you're good, you time things correctly and throw the person and block and grab and whatnot. But when you're like just kind of, you don't really know what's going on and you're just button mashing, that's what this is. It's like you kind of lost the plot. You're just spamming things, hoping it works.
Number 10, if it's there, you'll see it.
So if something, the example we put on the website, you know, if a notification pops up on Discord, you're going to see it, and you might be trying to stay focused, and so you see it and you have to go, I don't care about that right now, I'm going to try and stay focused on the thing, and you have to ignore it. But that takes willpower, and it pulls your attention, even briefly, and that's very different than just turning off notifications, where it never happens in the first place, and you just focus. And then when you're done with your Pomodoro or something, you can go check to see what notifications you might need to pay attention to. But acknowledge that if something pops up, your mind is built to see it and process it a little.
You have to believe it, number 11.
You put this on there. You explain it.
Okay. This one might sound a little new agey or something, but I don't care. I think in order for your brain to kind of make connections that you need to make, you have to believe that you're actually capable of doing something. If, let's say you want to be a rock star someday or something, but you keep telling yourself, oh, I'll never be that good, or I'll never be good enough, whatever, and you just keep going like that, your brain won't look for connections that it needs. You'll stop practicing because you think, oh, I'm not good enough, what's the point? Or you'll run into a little frustrating thing and you'll just give up. If you really believe that you can be that good, then your brain will keep trying and keep working on things because you know you'll get there. And it's sort of, I just think your brain needs to believe that it can actually accomplish something in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. in order to actually accomplish that thing.
Yeah. Good job.
Yeah. Okay. Number 12, fill the well. This is another one I put on the list.
Yeah. You go ahead.
I noticed that if I'm doing like 10, 20 minutes of just kind of sketching in the morning, just whatever comes to mind, just sketching, it really helps. And I've noticed this with music too. If you're just sort of, you want to improv for a little bit and just make something up, it helps a whole lot if you can kind of fill the well of your mind beforehand. So if I'm doing a drawing beforehand, I might look at some art books or just look at some pictures or whatever. Even reading a book, just kind of filling your head with good info or good inspiring things. And then same with music. If you plan on improvising or making up a song, it really helps to kind of listen to some music beforehand, have some fresh ideas in your head, and they will come out when you go to do the thing. So fill the well.
Get inspired, basically.
Number 13, you're wired to get distracted.
This feels like a sort of duplicate of,
yeah,
if it's there, you'll see it. Same concept. Your brain is looking for threats. It's trying to recognize anything that comes into your consciousness and evaluate it. And that is great if you're trying to make sure you don't get eaten by a bear. But when you're trying to focus on something, it's not so great. So eliminate those things.
I feel like a little bit different aspect to this is that people will blame themselves for getting distracted when they're working on something, I think, and feel bad about it. But your brain is actually supposed to be distracted. It's supposed to listen out for other things. And so it helps to change your environment and everything. But just recognizing the fact that your brain is actually supposed to get distracted is kind of interesting. Number 14, don't overpraise yourself. I'll take this one too.
Okay.
And then you can add to it. But I've noticed, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, don't put yourself down so much. You should be nicer to yourself, you know, whatever. And yeah, that's true. But I've also noticed the thing that never gets said is that you shouldn't overpraise yourself. And I don't mean like being super cocky and say, oh, I'm so awesome. But when you do something great, like let's say I paint a picture and I'm really proud of it. If I sit there and stare at it and sort of worship it and be like, oh my God, I'm finally good. It's finally amazing. And I've reached this new height or whatever. Well, what happens is the next time I go to do a painting, I will feel as if the bar has been raised sky high and there's nothing I can do. And so I will crash and burn on the next one. And I've just noticed that pattern of overpraising myself when I do something good, causing these extreme perfectionistic attributes in the next thing. So I've noticed that habit. And it makes sense. If you really, really care about something, when you get it right, you feel really, really good about it. And so it sort of makes sense that that becomes part of perfectionism. But
yeah, I learned this when I was teaching a lot. Yeah, everybody, most people understand that you shouldn't criticize a student and be harsh and go, oh, you suck, you're very bad at this, you should stop taking lessons. But the counter is also true. If you're constantly going, oh, you're so great, you did really good, awesome job, you're still drawing attention to them and building this self-awareness. And what you really want to do is draw attention to the thing that you're working on and bring, just have them focus on, here's the music, this is what it sounded like, this part was good, this part was not so good, and here's why. And that 100% applies to yourself as well. You don't, same as the Batman effect, where there's this spectrum of being very self-absorbed to outside yourself. Praising yourself is self-absorption. It's on the wrong end of the spectrum. You want to get outside of your own head, not more into it.
Number 15, the Skittles principle.
So if you go to the grocery store and you see a bag of Skittles and you think, I am not going to buy that because I am trying to not eat junk, lose weight, whatever, then that is a singular decision that you have to make when you walk by that bag of Skittles. But if you buy the bag of Skittles and you put it in a bowl and you put it on your dining room table and you think, okay, I'm not going to eat them, then you have to make that choice every single time you walk through the dining room forever, or until someone eats them. And as a general principle, whenever possible, you want to make a choice one time, not have to make an infinite number of choices stretched out across time from now until forever, because the latter is much harder.
I love that one, and I think about it all the time. Okay, number 16, prove your ideas.
This is you.
Okay. Well, I guess I should prove the fact that I put this on the list.
Yeah.
I have noticed that I have a tendency to, and I think a lot of people or everyone does this, but you have a tendency to build up these ideas in your head. And they take on these weird abstract aspects. And yeah, like, let's say you dream of writing a book one day and you have it all figured out in your head. Or you think you do. And it's going to be the best thing ever. It's going to change the world. It's going to be super well written. People are going to love it. And it's just, you figured it all out. And in your head, it truly is complete and done. And then you start to write the first sentence of that book, and it doesn't make any sense, and you have no idea what you're doing. What happens is that all the stuff in your head is not being checked by reality at all. It can run free in your weird dream brain and abstract thoughts. It has no need to be checked by reality. As soon as you start putting it into the real world, you begin to run into problems because what you were thinking doesn't actually make sense in the way that it needs to make sense. So you may have a good vague idea of something, but you have not translated it into reality yet. So I have learned myself not to let myself become too excited about something without beginning to prove it first. So prove your ideas. Number 17, if it's there, you'll see it.
Yeah, this is a duplicate, so whoops, okay. Probably my fault. Can I replace this with one that I meant to put on the list and haven't?
Yes.
I would call this one the thinker and the doer, in that you are made up of these two people, the thinker and the doer. The thinker makes plans and fantasizes about things and decides all of this awesome stuff that you're going to do. And the doer is the one that actually has to do it and sit down and grind through the work. And they're different people, and they work different ways. And it's often the case that you will spend all of your time as the thinker and never as the doer. Or as soon as it's time for the doer to take over, the doer's like, yeah, I don't know, it's whatever. And you're right back to being the thinker again. So it is important to train them both and think about them both as separate things. The end.
I like that a lot. Number 18, tight focus and dilated focus / the focus flashlight.
Your focus can be very tight and intense, focused on a very singular thing, or it can be very broad and more relaxed, and you will see the big picture and make broader connections and connect things that are far apart.
When you are looking at your phone, the bright glowing screen of your phone, that would be tight focus. When you're going for a walk next to a lake and you look out and see the scenery, that would be broad focus. And I feel like a lot of better things happen in your mind in that broad focus than in that super tight. But it's not a good or bad thing, but
yeah,
that would be an example.
But we tend to, we get sucked into the tight focus quite a lot, especially in modern society where almost everything is grabbing your attention and causing you to focus on something. Whereas decades ago, we didn't have that to a much lesser degree. So going around for a walk or staring at a fire or going to the beach, like that was much more common. So you had a lot more time to have a broad focus.
Number 19, the bike shed principle. And we're running a little bit behind. So
Okay. I love this one. This was an observation made in business where people tend to talk about things that are easy to understand and easy to form opinions on. The actual example given was a business meeting where there's two items on the agenda, a bike shed that they're going to build on the company campus that'll cost a few thousand dollars, and a giant nuclear power plant that's going to cost millions and millions of dollars. So everyone there goes, yeah, let's build the power plant. Sounds good. Surely everyone did their diligence. Seems fine. But the bike shed, I think it should be here. And I think the roof should be built out of tin. And no, I think it should be this. And everyone has opinions on the bike shed. That doesn't matter. It's tiny and cheap and insignificant compared to the nuclear power plant. But they can form opinions. It's something you can argue about. And that is everything that ever gets talked about in mainstream media, society, social media. It just that's all we are able to talk about is things that are simple and stupid.
Number 20, maximum recoverable focus.
In exercise, there is this concept of maximum recoverable volume, like in weightlifting, where you can lift a lot in one day. And if you lift too much, you're going to cross the threshold where you just can't really recover from it. And it's going to take you so long to recover that you're worse off, because if you had done a bit less, you would have recovered faster and you could have done another weightlifting session and you would have made more progress. So that's this notion of maximum recoverable volume. The same thing happens for mental expenditure. There is some limit to the amount of focus and work you can do in one day, where if you cross that limit, it just hurts you for tomorrow and you are better off having done less.
Number 21, doing something over and over does not make you better.
Driving to work and back every day, even if you drive for an hour in each direction, you can kind of attest to this, does not make you an F1 driver. You don't get better and better at driving just because you do it all the time. You get better when you first start driving, and then you find this threshold and you just cruise on there. It becomes this equilibrium. If you want to get really good, want to be a really, really good driver, then you have to be pushed in some way. You have to get out to a racetrack or do something that causes you to have to adapt to new skills. And that applies to everything you do. If you want to get good at something or progress at something, simply doing it over and over is not the entire formula. You have to push in some sense.
Yeah, you used typing as an example, which I thought was a really good one back in the day. Because everybody types, but not everybody is a great typer. And you would think that because we're all typing all the time, always, we would become really, really good at it. But,
but we don't.
You're not necessarily pushing yourself to try to get better. So, and you're able to function just fine. So you kind of just level out. Number 22, Wake up at the same time every day.
Yeah, just do this. Waking up is the first conscious choice that you make. It's the first habit of everything you do throughout the day. It's the anchor to your entire habit cycle. And the difference between waking up consciously or intentionally at a certain time and thinking, okay, I'm getting up now because I want to, because next comes this thing. I'm going to eat breakfast and I'm going to get dressed and I'm going to start work, or I'm going to work on this thing that I care about, is vastly different than sleeping in a little bit, not really sure, you're kind of rolling around in bed, you grab your phone, you scroll around on TikTok a little bit, and you're like, I guess I should get up. It's an utterly different trajectory for your entire day. Seriously, just do it. It's the best thing you can do.
Agreed. 23, momentum.
This is you. I don't know what this is.
You did a whole episode on momentum, I think. I don't even know how to describe it exactly, but it's just like waking up at the same time every day. Things build. You get better and faster. You're able to build these habits and figure out exactly what to do every single day, and it builds and builds. Your focus gets better. Your sleep gets better. If you're working out, you get stronger, and everything just builds. So this momentum just starts to carry you, and it becomes kind of amazing. So if you have been, I hate using the word productive, but if you have been very, very productive and or very focused on what you want to do, or you've been doing things the way you really want to do them for about 2 weeks, then I would say your momentum is very strong. And everything that was hard 2 weeks before that is now easy, and you're just killing it. And it's like the, you know, like in Mario or any game, you do enough good things in a row and then you get the star and you're invincible. Like, momentum is this incredible thing that you should strive for. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Okay. No.
24, time restraints. This is you.
We did what we called the 2-minute habit challenge, where we picked something we really wanted to do and we did it for 2 minutes a day only. You get to the end of 2 minutes and you're done. And it was incredibly eye-opening for many reasons that we can't talk all about today. But when you limit yourself to that very strict time scale, or even something bigger, it doesn't have to be extreme like 2 minutes, it causes you to, you have the novelty effect, right? Where you're excited about something, you really want to do it, and you do it, and then it's over, and you can't do it anymore. So all of the desire and interest has to go into thinking about it and planning on doing it the next day. It builds excitement and interest in continuing the habit. You feel like you want more, and so the next day you do it and you're thrilled to do it, but then you're still, you don't get all you want, and so you do it the next day. And it funnels all of your energy into actually building the habit and doing it continuously every day, rather than just going nuts and doing it for 4 hours on one day and then going, oh, okay, well, I'm kind of done. It's a fantastic way to build habits.
Number 25, your phone is a sponge.
You misspelled sponge. It's spounge.
No, I Googled it. That's the correct way to spell it. Apparently, there's like 3 different ways to spell it, and that is one of them.
I don't believe you.
Look it up. But first, describe your phone as a sponge.
Your phone has this amazing property in that if you're ever bored or uncomfortable or almost any vaguely negative emotion, you pull out your phone and your phone will amuse you. It will provide you with novelty and distraction. And it ends up where anytime your mind isn't actively sitting on something else, it just gets sucked into your phone. You're never bored. You're never just kind of observing the world or even having to kind of sit with negative emotions. It just sucks everything out of your brain, and it's terrible. The end. It sucks.
Yeah, we did the challenge where we left our phone in one place for a week, 2 weeks, a month. I don't remember how long. And it was amazing. the weird capabilities of your that your brain has when it's not constantly being sucked away by a spongy phone. You start to wonder about things. You start to think and reason through things and start exploring the world around you. Anyway, it was great. Yeah. Number 26, everything is your fault.
This is a controversial one for us. It's one of the first things we really put out there. We have even called it the founding principle of the overanalyzers. It is this belief that most things, obviously there are some exceptions, but most things are something that you have influence over. If your relationship fails, it's your fault. It's at least part your fault. And I know that there are times when that maybe isn't the case, but if you think that way, if you try and see things as your fault, that means that it's something that you can change and you have agency over. And trying to always look at the world from that lens means that you have this incredible power to change yourself, change the way you interact with the world, and you can become better and improve. It's a philosophy, and I think it's a really important one. It's just a way of viewing things. Like, I'm not good at my hobby because of some reasons that I'm not sure of, but it's my fault. Like, I could be. And that might feel crushing, but it's very empowering. You can get better. You can figure it out. You can become great at this thing that you work on.
I watched this video of a painter, and he's painting the scene in front of him, and he paints the background, he paints all of these objects, and then sort of towards the end, he does this like wash over the whole thing, and it would normally work out just great, but he had done something different for the background, and it just destroyed like the entire background. And what I would think if I did that was, oh, I should have used, or I hate these paints are stupid, or I'm cursed. Or, you know, you just have this feeling of being cursed. Oh, I'll never be a good painter, whatever. I'll never be good enough. And you're sort of blaming the universe, or you're blaming the medium you're using, or you're blaming the situation, whatever. But he looked at that. He's like, oh, what can I do to change it? Like, I shouldn't have done that. What can I do next to fix it? And it was just this immediate, oh, it was my fault. I can change it. It all the control was in him. And I just thought that was amazing and such a cool way to look at things. Okay. Yeah. Number 27, if it doesn't work, stop doing it.
I don't think there's a lot to explain here. This is a good thing to keep in mind. It is, if you observe, you will be shocked how often you will continue to do things even though they don't work out of stubbornness or you're too focused on something, unable to get the big picture perspective. So, yeah, if it doesn't work, don't do it.
This is so undervalued or unlooked at. People don't give this enough attention, and you think it's very clear. Oh, if it doesn't work, just stop. Well, yes, it's very simple, but this does not get enough attention. I see this a lot in academic stuff. People will believe that there's a specific right way to do something, and they will continue for their entire lives to try to do it that way, even if it doesn't work, because they believe that it is the right way to do it, even though it doesn't work. And I think if they would just look at the fact that every single time they try to do this thing, it doesn't work, they should probably just stop doing it. But they don't, because they believe that it is like the ultimate right way of doing it. And I think people would be a lot smarter if they could see themselves, oh, it doesn't work after 2 or 3 days. Let's try a different way. Let's try a little bit differently, or pick up a new method, or try that. It would save so much time. I would have years back on my life if I had just thought, oh, it's not working. Let's stop. But okay, number 28, longevity. This is very much like momentum. Actually, maybe it's different. I put this on here. Over the course of this podcast, I have begun to recognize and appreciate the day after day longevity of things. I feel like I used to, and still do to some extent, you know, if you sit down at the piano or whatever, and you want to get really good at piano, you can play for 8 hours or 10 hours or whatever and just give it everything you got. And the next day, try to do the same thing, but then it'll wear off and you'll get exhausted or it's too much work or whatever. I feel like I've been doing that for years, but from the talks that we've had, I've begun to see that doing it for 2 minutes a day over the course of a year is 1,000 times better than doing it for random, sporadic amounts of time, even if you have a whole lot of ambition towards it or a lot of attention put towards it. The being able to hold on to a habit for a longer period of time is just infinitely more valuable than short bursts of energy.
There's also a spaced repetition component to it, where when you do it frequently, mm-hmm. you're having to remember what you did before, and that's how you reinforce memories and things in your head. Whereas if you do just this big giant binges, you know, on one Saturday you do 8 hours, you're not really having to recall anything because it's all just in your head from that session, and then you go for this big long gap, you don't get the benefits of the spaced repetition by doing it that way.
Okay, we should probably speed up a little bit. Okay. Number 29, 3 month identity. I put this in here. I've noticed in the last couple years, because we've been doing these calendars for the whole year and trying to make yearly goals and stuff, the New Year's resolutions I come up with on January 1st, I had to count the months. By the end of March, I'm looking at the calendar and I pretty much don't care about them anymore. And I almost feel like I'm a different person. And I've noticed that every 3 months, all of my priorities, not all, but a lot of my priorities just totally shift. And it's really weird. But if you look back 3 months and look at all of the things you were thinking about, chances are they're completely different than what you value today. And so it's just this weird thing that I've noticed is this 3 month identity change. Mm-hmm. Number 30, the sacred morning. You talk about this because you've discovered it recently.
Yeah. When you wake up, your brain is kind of wide open, and almost anything you put in there, it occupies a lot of mind space. I can wake up, look at my phone, see the headline of a news article or Discord comment, something, and then I go do my thing, walk the dog for the next half hour, and it's like all I can think about. It really wedges itself in there. So being very particular about what you choose to think about and what you expose yourself to in the morning is very important. And ideally, you think about things that you care about and want to think about, because your mind is just wide open at that point, and you want to point it at the right things, not the wrong things.
Number 31, do the scary thing.
Yeah, when I think all of us, or many of us, have these sort of fantasies in our head, or I'm going to start a business, I'm going to do this thing or that thing, I'm going to be a rock star. I just, you know, it's not time yet, or there's this thing that's in the way. And that's fine. It's really fun to have fantasies and to believe that you could be living this much better life, being more fulfilled. There's just something in the way. But it's probably worth trying to do it, because that causes you to have to resolve your fantasy thinking with reality. And it's very humbling, and it causes you to have to kind of come to terms with what's real and really put your effort into the right places and learn how to work.
32, match activity to mind state.
Yeah, if you're at your peak focus, your mind is super sharp, don't go do something dumb. Don't play video games. Don't wash the dishes. Work on something that you really care about. And when you're fried and your brain's not really working anymore, then go waste time and chill or whatever. But you don't... Your mental state changes dramatically every day. You have periods of intense peak mental ability, and you have periods where you're kind of useless. And acknowledge that and use them wisely.
33, the first one in the game effect.
This might have been one of the first things we actually gave a name to, which is pretty fun. It probably should be first on the list, at least if we were sorting them by that. So if you buy a new board game, or you start a new PC game or something, the person who starts first, the first person to pick up the instructions, start figuring things out, they have no one to ask or rely on. They just, if they want to learn how something works, they just have to figure it out. The person who comes after, they don't have that. They have this person who's a little bit farther ahead than them. So they tend to ask questions and go, oh, how does this work? What do I do with this thing? What's the rule here? They rely on that first person. And it's very often the case where the first one in the game becomes the expert. And they just stay the expert from then on. They're just the one who knows how it works and is tends to be better at it. Because they've adopted a completely different mindset than the person who came after. Even though the difference sometimes is really small, it could just be a few minutes. They just happen to be first, but they've been put into this mental state that sticks with them, and it's very powerful, and it's something you should think about for everything you do.
34, the Pomodoro technique. Make this fast.
Set a timer for 25 minutes and work on one thing and focus on it. And then when the timer dings, take a break.
Perfect. 35, the Waluigi effect. This is one of my favorites.
Yeah. So there's Luigi, a character in the Mario universe, and he's good and wholesome, and he helps Mario and saves the princess and does good things. And there's Waluigi, which literally means a bad Luigi, and bad Luigi does bad things and screws up plans, and he's a bad guy. So you'd think that they're these two far opposite ends of the spectrum. There's good over here, and there's bad way over here with this huge gap in between. But they're actually extremely close. If you want to create Luigi, it's very difficult. You have to build up the entire Mario universe. You have to introduce Peach and Goombas and Koopas and Blocks and the entire Nintendo franchise and history and all the things that go around that and the music and all that. And that's how you create Luigi. If you want to create Waluigi, you just, like, change a couple little things. Like, no, he's not good, he's bad. Instead of being nice, he's mean. And you wind up with Waluigi. And the way that that's relevant as sort of a metaphor is that you can spend all this time constructing this wonderful, shining, positive version of yourself. And you think that you're so far away from the bad version of you. You're just, that's the far opposite end. But you're not. You're never far from the anti-you. It's right there, and it doesn't take a lot to just sort of flip back into Wah Mike or Wah Dan. And it's humbling, and it's something you should always remember. Never take it for granted. There's not a lot between you and the bad version of you.
Okay, 36, the proximity effect.
There's a saying in business that you optimize what you measure. This is very similar in that you pay attention to the things that you see and that are obvious and that demand your attention. The stuff that you don't see, you don't tend to pay attention to. An example of this from the health world is diabetes. There's so many people who are well on the path to developing type 2 diabetes that don't even know it, because the nature of that illness is that your blood sugar gets out of control and your insulin doesn't work well, and you don't tend to really have symptoms, so you tend to just not really think about it. But it's hugely damaging. And that is a bad example of the proximity effect, in that because it's not drawing your attention, you don't tend to pay attention to it, even though it's very important.
37, the Dunning-Kruger effect.
I love this one. Everyone gets this wrong. There is this pop culture take or sort of morphing of the Dunning-Kruger effect, a memification. And the memification is that people who are really good at something think that they're bad, and the people who are really bad at something think that they're good. That's not what this is. I mean, maybe that's a thing that's fun to think about, but that is not what the Dunning-Kruger effect actually observed, or what was observed by Dunning and Kruger. The Dunning-Kruger effect is this phenomenon where virtually everyone, in the absence of any kind of hard data, if you're just guessing, if you said, hey, how funny are you? How smart are you? How healthy are you? Virtually everyone will say, I don't know, like probably a little bit above average, probably like 60%, maybe 70%. Everyone thinks that they're there. And by definition, we all cannot be there. Some of us are in the bottom 10%. Some of us are in the top 5%. But there's this incredible mental gravity towards that point, that a little bit above average.
38, continuity.
The connection between the today you and future you and past you. This relates to some of the things we already talked about, like the maximum recoverable focus, or just the general concept of trying to set yourself up in the future to do what you want to do. So a trick that I have when I'm working on something and I need to stop, I will find things that are very easy and very fun and put them at the top of the list and leave them for tomorrow me. Or when I have to get going, I got to push the motivation train a little bit. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, this thing, this seems cool. This will be fun. And I'll go do this simple, trivial little thing that I left for myself. And that gets me going. And then I try to do the same thing for tomorrow me. And you build this connection between all the versions of you from day to day.
39, focus improves over time.
Focus is not a superpower. It's not just this thing you concentrate super hard and now you're focused. It's a skill. It's an attribute. And if you've been in a really bad place and you haven't been focused at all, you waste all your time on your phone and don't really pay attention to anything, it's an uphill climb. But understand that it's not this giant personal failure that you can't focus or can't focus for long. It's that that muscle has atrophied. And so you practice a bit and you start focusing a little bit more and eventually it just gets better and better. And eventually it's not that big of a deal.
40, chaotic eras and stable eras.
This is from a book called Three Body Problem, this series, which I loved and I cannot recommend enough. Sometimes life is in a stable era where things are predictable and they make sense and you feel good and there's nothing terribly wrong. And those are times when you really want to work and focus and enjoy that and push yourself a little bit. And other times you're in a chaotic era where life is a little crazy or sad or stressful, or it can even be depressing and miserable. And when you're in a chaotic era, you can't hold yourself to the same standard. You survive, you try and get through it, you do what you have to do, and life will get back to a stable era again, and that's when you can push again.
41, the can't stop, won't stop.
I think this is commonly called hyperfocus in the ADHD world. You can get focused on something, and that's great, but you can get so focused that you can't unfocus, and it starts to occupy all of your mind, and your executive function is not able to detach you from that thing, and it's at best unproductive most of the time. Sometimes it's even destructive. It violates the maximum recoverable focus. You can get really sucked into something, you can do some really bad work, you can get really fatigued. It's generally not a good state of mind to be in. So beware the hyperfocus or the can't stop, won't stop effect.
42, name things.
So you probably noticed that a lot of the names on this list are kind of stupid, and that's on us. But if they didn't have a name, then they wouldn't be something that we talked about or ever remembered. The focus train doesn't make sense. It's a weird metaphor, and it's amazing because I think about it all the time because it has a name. If it didn't have a name, it would have just been a conversation we had that we don't remember. It's very important to name things, even if they're dumb. In fact, dumb names might be better because they can be more memorable, because it gives you a handle. You can reason about something now. It becomes a real thing that you can think about.
43, fix your sleep.
You're only as good as your physical health, and sleep is the foundation of that. You really have to sleep well, and that isn't just time, although a lot of people don't sleep long enough. One of them is you. But you also need to have deeper sleep and regular sleep. There's different cycles that your body needs to get into and out of, and they affect different things about you. They can affect your emotions. They can affect your short-term memory. So prioritizing regular sleep, go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time. Your bedroom should be cold. It should be very dark. It should not be interrupted by noise. You would likely benefit from some techniques about relaxation and clearing your mind. And sleep is the kind of thing that improves over time. It is not just a, okay, I did everything, now I'm good, tonight should be awesome sleep. It is something that you just have to continuously work on. But if you can get really good sleep, that is of tremendous benefit to you as a human.
I feel like the solution to that is included in the next one. 44, change your environment rather than change yourself.
Yeah, and actually sleep is a great example of this. Similar to the Skittles principle, if you're trying to develop a new habit, trying to change yourself forever, then that's a choice that you have to make over and over and over if you're trying to build a new behavior. And it does, you adapt to it, it does become easier, but those, no matter what, those things are hard. You know, I've been trying to floss my teeth, and that is hard. I was doing good, and then I stopped. It's a struggle, and it's the stupidest, simplest thing, but it's really hard because I have to make that choice every single day. And if I stop making that choice to do it, then it just starts to slip and whatever. If you can change your environment, that's amazing. An example I love to talk about and have talked about many times is automated lights, where they dim in the evening and they shut off at a certain time. The thermostat is automated as well. It cools down at night, which is, we said, part of sleep. But any change you can make to the environment that sticks, you do that once and that's it. It affects you forever. It's a free win. Just do that. If anything you can change about the environment, 100% prioritize that.
45, relaxing is a mind state, not an activity.
I feel like this is you. Why don't you take this one?
I feel like this is both of us, and this was a while ago, so I'm trying to remember it, but... Oh, someone, I think it was Emily, in the YouTube comments, I think, asked us to talk about relaxing. And when we started to talk about it, or started to think about it, we realized that listing activities that are relaxing was almost impossible, because you could think of it going either way for anything. Like, some person might list, I don't know, bike ride as relaxing, but then you can think about biking on a, you know, crowded street, or being really angry while you're riding a bike, whatever. Or you can think about meditation as relaxing, but there's a lot of times where we've tried meditating where you become very upset and angry or stressed or whatever. Like, the activity doesn't seem to define relaxation. It is the mind state that you're in that's actually relaxing. So it's more important to focus on how do you get into the right mind state in order to relax. So mm-hmm. If you're planning a vacation somewhere, you really want to make sure that when you go on that vacation, you don't have to worry about everything else. You don't want to worry about work that you have that you're going to have when you get back, or anything like that. You want your mind state to be relaxed, not just the activity.
Yeah. A good example for me, some people will say, oh, you should take a hot bath. And for me, I guess I'm just a weirdo, but sweating in a disgusting pool of my own filth does not make me relaxed. So I need something else to get me into the right mind state.
Okay, 46, slippage.
This is similar to the novelty effect, subtly different. If you start something new, you decide you're going to eat more healthy, you're going to start a new exercise routine, it's pretty common that you'll start off strong and you'll be doing really good and you feel like you've got it. But then as your attention starts to move to other things and it's no longer this thing that's on your mind all the time, oftentimes it will start to slip and you may not even notice. I mean, sometimes you do. If you have a diet and you fall off, you're like, okay, well, I've busted my diet. But if you're just trying to make better, healthier choices and you get into, as time goes on, you're not thinking about it so much, it just slips. And it's very helpful when possible to have some kind of objective metric, because it's just very easy to have these things degrade over time without you really realizing. This is a common problem in a lot of health studies. They look at people, they put them on a diet or do some behavioral intervention, and then they have to account for the fact that the people over the course of years just do a worse job at whatever it is they're supposed to be doing. They just get worse because of slippage.
The number 47 is Everything Is Your Fault, which we, of course, already talked about. And that is my fault. I believe I added that one, so I'm sorry. 48, Focus on Something That Isn't Winning.
Yeah. This one's a bit... It's a bit subtle, but when I'm playing competitive games, like competitive PC games, which is a thing that I tend to do, I've noticed this very powerful phenomenon where if I queue up and I'm going to play these games and I want to win, and I play the game and I'm focused on winning and I'm just thinking, what do I got to do to win? What do I got to do to win? I tend to not do well and I tend to not learn much. And it generally is a bad state of mind. And I believe it is because thinking about winning, it's very similar to that spectrum in the Batman effect, where when you're very self-absorbed and thinking about me and how I'm doing and what I'm doing, you're in kind of the bad mind state. If you're focused on the thing in front of you, trying to recognize what's happening and improve yourself and make adjustments, then you're in a good mind state, and that kind of gets you out of that self-absorbed mode. So it's hard to not pay attention to winning. And a parallel would be, you know, if you're working on your art, you're playing guitar, you're doing something like that, thinking about how good you're doing, or, you know, oh man, I'm nailing this, I'm definitely improving, I'm doing really well. It's kind of the same thing. It's like focusing on winning. Pick something else to focus on. Sometimes it can be something stupid. Just focus on watching your fingers move instead of thinking about how great you're doing. And it can get your mind into the right place and take your attention off of that self-absorbed winning identity thing.
All right, the last two. 49, Self One, The Thinking Self.
One of the best books we've ever read and things we've gotten into has been Tim Galloway's The Inner Game of Tennis. And the gist of the book, it's highly worth a read. It's very short. And it applies far beyond tennis. But the gist of it is that you kind of have these two pieces of yourself. There's what he calls Self One and Self Two. I'm going to go ahead and explain 49 and 50 together because they're the same thing. Yeah. 49 is self one, 40 or 50 is self two. Self one is the conscious you. It's the logical, thinks in words, reasons about things version of you. Self two is the unconscious part of you. It's the part that handles swinging a tennis racket or moving a paintbrush, and it does pattern recognition and motor control and all of those instinctive, reflexive type of things. And they both have these very important roles where self one, its job is to put you in the right place, to hire the right tennis coach, to decide to go out and practice versus not. It can make logical observations about things, can think like, you know, I think I should try hitting my backhand this way rather than that way. It can make those types of choices. But it also has a tendency to become very self-absorbed. This is similar to the last one, like thinking about winning and how you're doing. It tends to be very self-critical. Although, like we said, being critical and praising are kind of two sides of the same coin. It has a tendency to think about how you're doing. And that interferes with self too. And self too is this, we said, pattern learning and reflexive, instinctual thing. And it needs to be put in the right place, in the right environment, and then kind of left alone. If your mind is just running through all this, oh, that was a bad shot, that was a good shot, and constantly hyper-analyzing, self two gets kind of drowned out and isn't really able to make the adaptations and just explore and learn in this sort of playful discovery kind of way. So that's this relationship between the two. I genuinely think this is one of the biggest and most important things that we have talked about. Yeah, out of this list of 50, this is top five for me. Just understanding this relationship between self one and self two, and anything that you do that you're trying to improve or do well at, practicing putting them in the correct places, and in particular, not letting self one kind of stomp on self two.
That's the whole list.
Yeah, that was 50 minus a couple that we kind of screwed up.
Yeah. But I think the whole idea of this, and this is definitely not everything we've talked about. There's over 100 hours of us talking, and we definitely did not skim back through that. But I think we like this idea of making a master list of all these little things that we've mentioned before, and we want to keep adding to it. And if anyone has suggestions or things they remember that we did not put on the list yet, then let us know. But this will be on, or it is on our website right now. Just go to theoveranalyzers.com and you'll see it. It's called the big list of names, and it's all there. And hopefully this will help us kind of keep track of the stuff we talk about. This has been helpful for me because I've forgotten half of these or just haven't been thinking about them.
And this is our 100th episode, and that's pretty neat. We made it this far. So a tremendous thanks to everybody who's hung out and submitted ideas and discussed things with us. And we really would not be here without that. So thank you so much.